Put aside the ego and embrace the moment.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom.
Well, there we are. The phone continues to ring. And if you don't eat your greens, you won't get no pudding. You won't eat no pudding if you don't eat your greens. It's Pink Floyd and The Wall, another break-in. We don't need no education. Surely Graham can't be having some kind of dig at the educational system of the country. It's his show, after all. Sound and Director's Vision. Graham Harper, Sound and Director's Vision. How are you, Graham?
Good afternoon. Yes, I'm very well. Thank you very much. Yes, that piece of music. Gosh, it really affected me when I heard that The Wall. I thought it was a fantastic album, brilliant musicianship, etc., and really interesting songs. So in 1981, I did the director's course at the BBC, which was over 2 or 3 months. And during the course, we were asked to do four or five pieces, ending with a large piece. I was doing a drama section of the course, so my last piece was going to be a 30-40 minute piece of drama. But to start with, we had to use two pieces of music. So the first piece of music I chose was Another Brick in the Wall, part one, because it's in three sections. And when I listened to that piece of music, it just reminded me of my concerns of the lack of information from my father, who during the Second World War, when he enlisted in the army, was sent to Burma. And he never spoke to me about any of it. I asked him questions. He never said a word about what he'd seen, what had happened or whatever, only that he'd survived. And I wondered how horrific it had been for him. And this piece of music made me think of all the people during both on all sides of the war, whether they were the Germans or they were the Japanese or indeed the whole of Europe, the awful things and the deaths of so many people because of this awful war. And this piece of music really summed that up for me. I was emotionally moved to think about all those events that had happened in the Second World War. And so what I did when I heard this piece of music, I chose it for my first piece that I had to direct and shoot. You had to create the whole thing yourself. So I decided to take a whole series of images from both socially in England and also memories in photographs of long lost people who died during the war, etc., or went missing. And I made this 3 or 4 minute short of all these images to that piece of music. And I got quite an accolade for it from the course leader, who thought it was very imaginative and haunting. And it did me very good, because with these pieces of film that I was making, this being the first one, you could then send those finished films with your resume, if you like, to various producers to try and get yourself your first job as a director. And it helped me, plus others, but it helped me to excite Julia Smith, would you believe, who was doing a series called Angels for BBC. It was a soap opera about nurses in the 1980s. And she gave me my first break. And the break she gave me absolutely helped me to set my career on course, because I was able to give a really nice, not big, but a small body of work of my ability to direct. And it got me some good work in the future.
Of course, Julia Smith would also go on to develop EastEnders and carve a place in British broadcasting history from then onwards, effectively.
Absolutely.
Did you ever do EastEnders, actually? I can't remember whether you have. I know you've done Coronation Street. You have, yes.
I did. She asked me to come. She was very fond of me. I was very lucky because she's quite a tricky woman, but I knew her quite well because I'd been a first assistant director to her as a director, would you believe, before she produced. So she knew me as a person and my integrity or what she thought about it. And she offered me EastEnders. She asked, I wasn't going to be the first director on EastEnders, but I was going to be the second one. The first one was Matthew Robinson, who then went on to produce it and also be a producer in his own right, as well as direct many things. He was going to set it off or kick it off, and she wanted me to be number two. Unfortunately, I was involved in something else and had to turn the work down. And strangely enough, I don't know whether she was bitter about that, she never came back to me for EastEnders, but she did offer me another series, which was in Wales, which we all called Dyke on a Bike. I'm sorry about that. That's not meant to be.
Others might say District Nurse. Others might say it's just Nurse Hughes.
That's the word. And that's the lady. And eventually I got to do that. But I didn't ever do EastEnders with her. But later on, a good 10 years later, would you believe, I have done and had done quite a few blocks of EastEnders. I haven't done it for quite a long time now, but Certainly at the turn of the 20th, the millennium, I was definitely working on EastEnders then, but she wasn't there.
And of course, going back to that Pink Floyd and the Wall, there was a very substantial piece of animation produced in the original video. This was obviously in the era where pop videos hadn't quite got the credentials of being on MTV wall to wall. So it was the late 70s when this was actually there. But I did think it was quite an impressive aspect, taken, of course, from the feature film. And Pink Floyd, clearly known in the 60s for being a very experimental progressive rock band, probably reached what for some of their fans actually was their finest hour. For others actually felt actually that they'd maybe sold out and gone commercial. Were you a Floyd fan before you actually heard The Wall?
Yes, I loved the Pink Floyd. I thought their music was so innovative and interesting and great musicianship. Well, by the time Pink Floyd were really taking off, rock and roll musicians like Eric Clapton, etc. I mean, there was a stunning group of musicians. I don't know whether they actually read music, any of them, but they certainly knew how to play drums and guitars or whatever. Very, very extraordinary abilities, etc., in musicianship. And this band was unique.
Of course, Floyd, also known as being part of the psychedelic movement, and Sid Barrett, of course, one of the founding members, sadly came to a sticky end. There was an era, certainly end of the 60s, where lots of experimental narcotic substances were being put around. You don't have to answer this if you don't want to, Graham. After all, it is your show. Were there ever any times when you were slightly tempted to say, oh, maybe I should try some lysergic acid, diethylamine, or whatever?
Not at all. I did enjoy occasionally marijuana, but that was the extent of my drug taking. No, I didn't ever get into cocaine or acid or whatever. I didn't need to because I was really happy and enjoying my life anyway. And I found great happiness in just life. I didn't need to take those kind of drugs to hallucinate and become something else.
Absolutely. So Arthur Rubinstein, he is something else when it comes to piano playing and the Boston Pops Orchestra. And we're moving a few centuries back in time now, after obviously the 60s and the jazz quartets and the music, obviously the 70s and Pink Floyd and so on. We move back to the era of a decomposing composer, technically, Ludwig van Beethoven. And of course, this particular aspect, which is the very well-known, of course, Emperor Piano Concerto, the second movement. I mean, you could have gone for the first movement. That's 20 minutes in length. It would have taken that big chunk of the program. But, you know, you've gone for the second movement. Is this also something which kind of impacted you in a kind of cinematic sense, in an emotional sense, or in both?
I think it's both. It's interesting because jazz and classical music are... I think jazz is the classical music of modern times, if you like. I mean, it is not only, but it is an aspect of classical music to me. I wasn't brought up on classical music, but I found, I suppose, Beethoven. I'll tell you who actually got me interested in classical music. I became interested in classical music through a series of films that Ken Russell made at the BBC during the early 60s, I think. And one of the films he made was about the last days of the life of Delius. I had never really listened to any Delius. Oh, the Song of Summer, I think, is the piece he really concentrated on. And it was a story about Delius, who now was dying of a horrible illness. And he couldn't write anymore. He couldn't compose in writing. So Eric Fenby, who was a young musician, agreed to write down the notes that he gave. And when you watch this film, you saw Delius go, this old man going, very irritably going, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And Eric Fenby was supposed to understand what that awful drone was meant to be. So you never knew whether Eric Fenby composed this piece of music or Delius.
Got to say, Graham, it's not exactly Lark Ascending, is it, really?
No. But out of this was born this beautiful piece of music. And it caught me as a young man. It caught my attention, and I began to listen to more Delius. And then I heard, obviously I knew of Beethoven. I heard Beethoven, the Pastoral, and then the Emperor became my second one. And I loved the Emperor. The big, big orchestral sound of the opening of the Emperor and the beautiful piano playing, which was by Arthur Rubinstein, was absolutely stunning and really hit me. And then you get the second movement, which is so gentle and so beautiful and romantic and emotional. And it struck, I used to play this every morning before I went to work at the BBC as a young floor assistant, because it got me stirred up and excited. So I had to get up an hour and a half before I was going to work to listen to this piece of music. I did. I listened to it every day for many, many years. And I chose it when I was doing the film course eventually at the BBC as a director, young director. I chose this piece of music as an emotional background to a very, very sad thing that I'd written, a piece of drama about a young woman who is walking to a graveyard or through a graveyard to a grave. And you realise that she's actually going to pay homage to her husband, who also died, obviously, very young. And I think I've made it again in the Second World War. This must have been on my mind. Well, and I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, because actually the Second World War was obviously still very much within living memory in that particular stage. We're still talking. I mean, it's interesting. Now, here we are in 2021, a long time ago, but actually a lot longer than the period between 1978, 79, 80, which was literally 25 years ahead of, well, 35 years after the Second World War. So again, still very much within living memory.
No, it was. There were many films still being made about the Second World War. And it really touched me, and it laid beautifully behind the various moments of this young woman going to the grave, and then her mother turns up, etc. And there's a terrible discussion between the two of them where she doesn't really have much time for her daughter. It's quite a sad piece that I'd written. I don't know what I was thinking of, but anyway. But I was moved to write this, would you believe, to that piece of music. So the other day I was talking about how you do a piece of film and then the composer creates a piece of music for you. But in fact, this was another occasion where the music spurred me on to write something for which that music, that piece of music, could actually lay as a lovely piece of background of emotion to the piece. Again, I did very well in the film course. I got another accolade for great use of a lovely piece of music.
And again, to give it its full title, it's the Piano Concerto No. 5, The Emperor, in E-flat major, Opus 73, the second movement, Adagio un poco moto, which is basically a slow and gracefully, a little slow and gracefully, I suppose, if my Italian musical translation still stands why. Adagio, I think, was gracefully from that point of view. So let's hear it.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Graham Harper's Sound and Director's Vision here on Siren Radio and also a podcast on Southside Broadcasting. We are skipping around the decades and we've obviously had some substantial musical entrees, including obviously two of which have been tied in with your director's course at the BBC. I have to ask, Graham, given that clearly we're talking about the early days of VHS there, long before digitalization and so on, and long before many students currently will actually have their whole portfolio put together, do you still actually have those original films that you shot? Are they still kept carefully in your collection somewhere?
Oh, yes. Oh, no, I haven't lost them. I've still got them. I haven't looked at them, and I certainly haven't shown them to anybody now, because I hope that I've actually improved and developed a bit more than that. But there they are. They stand as a proof that I actually did do something.
Absolutely, and you continue to do so. So have you digitised them, or are they still kept on tape or film?
No, they're still on film. Well, no, the film must exist somewhere. No, they're on tape, absolutely.
Right.
And it was a strange form of tape in those days. I'm trying just to remember what it was called. It certainly Betamax? Wasn't VHS.
Was it Betamax?
It was Betamax. Mm. Archaic. Well, it wobbled.
And as I say, you obviously must look to get those digitized before too long. Otherwise, who knows what could actually happen? Storage material and so such like. Anyway, enough of such stuff. We could spend hours talking about VHS versus Betamax. How Betamax was supposed to be the better quality, but VHS had the better marketing, as far as I can recall. That was the rationale. And actually, you know, domestically being able to actually record television programs, outrageous. Still, never mind. Moving on from that sort of perspective, of course, we're back to the world of rock, of course, with Keith Moon, Pete Townsend, Roger Daltrey. Who? Why have we gone with these guys?
Oh, I love The Who. I've always loved the Rolling Stones, but The Who were stunning. Again, the great musicians, really clever, great singer, really clever drumming, clever bass player. It was really smart, a really great rock and roll outfit. Won't Get Fooled Again is really a song of my generation. Definitely, oh, there we are, my generation. That's one of their great songs.
That's no substitute.
Just great songs.
And you'll be able to see for miles.
Really telling you something, really saying something, really, really.
Boris the Spider is running the country. Sorry, I'll stop there.
Say again.
Boris the Spider is running the country.
He is. So at the end of the course, my end piece, which was to be a 30 or 40 minute drama, you had to write it yourself or have it written for you. You had to create something and then put music to it and cast it and get your small crew together and go and shoot this thing. And I had a friend at drama school who, when he left, decided, although he was an actor, he decided to try his hand at writing, and he became a very successful writer. Even at this time, as a very young man, he suddenly started to get his work recognised. His name was Hugh James, or is Hugh James. And Hugh, I approached him and said, look, would you write me something based on, I don't know, radicals? I wanted something like the National Front, a story about the National Front. Two people from the National Front been on a rally, get trapped somewhere and get themselves sorted out by somebody else, whatever you want to do. But that's the kind of thing. I hadn't thought about this piece of music by this time. So Hugh wrote a fabulous little piece of drama involving a man of 40, National Front, sort of leader, if you like, on the run with a younger guy, also from the National Front, from thugs, from the Labour side, if you like, the socialist side, the left wing, who were chasing them down the street or whatever. And they hide in a basement area of an old Victorian house. An old lady opens and says, what are you doing here? And they say, oh, let us in. They break, push forward and go in. And there's a confrontation between them and this old lady who tells them what for, basically, and really sorts them out. A really interesting piece of writing. And I, when I heard The Who, because I was thinking, what kind of music can I have to open this piece up and also end with? And I thought of Won't Get Fooled Again, which kind of sums up in the words exactly what I felt about Here We Go Again with the National Front. You know, don't listen to these people, et cetera, et cetera. Very nationalistic, right-wing thugs these guys were. And this piece of music just summed up the situation really well. And I think the Who have a great voice. I think they've always been revolutionary, like the Stones, but they're very truthful. There's a very strong heart from that band. And I think it showed, hopefully, in my piece with their piece of music.
It's 8.5 minutes. And because it is your show, Graham, we will play it all.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you. Thank you.
course, it's not just Graham's selection of the joys of The Who and Won't Get Fooled Again. I think, if memory serves, they use a snippet of that for the theme tune to CSI Miami. In terms of the sequence that's there with Horatio Crane, I think, played by David Caruso in the lead role. I think they use the same sort of thing there. So you know, obviously you paved the way in terms of your selection back in the late 70s for clearly what became one of the prime crime drama series of the CSI badge in the 21st century. Just goes to show, good music sustains the test of time, he's trying to say. few other sort of bits and pieces to just reflect on, Graham. In terms of, obviously, we've listened to the music, but culturally, of course, a lot of changes are happening in the sort of 12 years we've kind of jumped through over the last sort of few shows. I'm thinking particularly, you mentioned about the National Front there. You can go back to Enoch Powell and his Rivers of Blood speech at the back end of the 60s. You can think about the three-day week, the joining of the common market, which for our generation was meant to be a life-affirming, life-confirming long aspect and a whole sea change for British politics. And so on, and of course the onset of Callaghan's crisis, what crisis system, which paved the way with punk music for a whole variety of other things. Were you aware of those things? Were they in the background? Did they impact in terms of your directorial choices or your artistic choices? I mean, from what you've said in terms of your description for the National Front sort of aspect, probably you were actually in terms of the sort of things that were happening and that were in the news.
I was very aware of, Enoch Powell, to be honest, he was very right. The Rivers of Blood sort of have happened, not necessarily. Yes, they did. It happened here. Steve McQueen has showed. In America more so, but still here. I was very aware of the National Front and nationalism. I don't agree with any of that. I was very aware of all these political events going on, and they did affect me. But I also looked on the bright side all the time. Always look on the bright side of life. Felt that right would be good over evil, and up to now it does seem to win, hopefully. Good does do better over evil, and I try and show in all my work, I try and show where I can in the acting, not that I'm acting, but when I'm working with actors, I try to get to the depth and the heart and soul of the characters. Because it isn't all just black and white. There's lots of shades of grey, etc. in all of this. You can have, I'm sure, National Front people who've also got some good aspects to them. I'm trying to think of the words, sorry. I think there is good to be got out of it, but certainly not in believing what the National Front believes in. The National Front, I don't know about now, but in the 70s and 80s, they really were quite a strong, powerful group of people. Unfortunately, there are many more people who don't. Democracy overcomes all of that. And as long as we keep fighting for democracy and the good of democracy, we will win over that.
Well, this is not a political platform, so we'll ease away from the politics at this stage. But it's interesting to obviously get that perspective. And I think it certainly provides a refreshing input in terms of other aspects. We're closing this particular episode of Graham Harper's Sound and Director's Vision with another classic, it might be said, and also very romantic, almost a mushy classic, you might well say, in terms of Reginald Dwight, key Watford supporter who changed his name to a certain Sir Elton Hercules John.
Yes. So your song is the song. I've listened to, I think, all of Elton John's songs. I certainly love Yellow Brick Road, which got me onto him. And there are some marvellous songs on that. Marvellous, marvellous pieces of music. Again, a great musician. So your song is an odd piece for me to use because I like more dramatic, if you like, or more emotive, but this is a very beautiful song in reality. So I was in 1983-84, I was invited by a producer called John King, who unfortunately is no longer with us, who worked for BBC television up in Birmingham and at Pebble Mill. And he spotted me and made contact with me and said, would I like, he was doing a programme called The Golden Oldies Picture Show. Now, in the 60s, a lot of music, there was no pop videos in those days. The BBC used to make silly kind of romantic pop videos of trees and flowers and lovers walking through the undergrowth or whatever, to various pieces of rock and roll or gentle ballads or whatever. There were no pop videos as such, whereas in the 70s onwards, it took off. So he, in the 1980s, decided to create this show where young directors for Threepence Halfpenny pay and about a pound in the pocket to go and make, as a budget, to go and make videos, pop videos, that were missing from the 60s. And you could choose from about 200 songs, any song from the 60s, and he would approve it and think that your idea was great or not. And if he liked your idea of the visuals you're going to create, the story you're going to tell, he would find the funds for you to do that. And I think for £1,500, which was quite a lot in those days in the 80s, but not enough to make a pop video, really, and a film crew.
Well, Graham, according to Ian Fleming, James Bond, the character, actually had £1,000 tax-free expenses on his account. So it was £500 more than James Bond had in the original novels. There we are.
Hey! So I was doing well. And you went off and you made your pop video. You cast it. So your 1,500 quid had to buy you actors and whatever props and equipment you needed. And the film. The crew were free, but the film you had to pay for, and that was quite expensive. Anyway, so I chose, I had about six of these pop songs, and one of them was your song. And when I listened to, because I liked your song, I thought it was a lovely ballad. And when I listened to it, and I listened to it, over thinking about an idea, I want to use this song, so what can I come up with for that? And I listened to it. I must have listened to it 30 or 40 times. And for some reason, all I could see was Charlie Chaplin, the tramp, the Charlie Chaplin's tramp, and that little guy, there was a little boy. I wrote a little piece which was about Chaplin-esque tramp character with this little boy, both penniless, walking down the street. They come across a shop outside of fruit and veg laid out, etc. And there's a big fat Fatty Arbuckle kind of character laying, you know, sorting out the vegetables and the fruit. And there's some apples there. And he kind of claps his hands together, very pleased with himself, goes into the shop. And the two characters, main characters, the tramp and the boy, walk up, see the apples, and Charlie Chaplin says, be very careful, keep quick, make sure you do exactly what I do. Takes two apples, and as he takes two apples, out comes the Fatty Arbuckle character, kicks him up the bottom, and there's a little tussle, the little boy rushes around, we create a little bit of comedic silliness, and they push the fat man into the fruit and veg, and they both run off. And then there's a little sequence of them both happy with their bits of their apple. I mean, I'm teaching people to thieve here, eating their apples, putting their arms around each other's shoulders, and they walk off happy into the sunset. And by chance, on the location that I used in the country, a duck and the mother duck and four little ducklings walked across the foreground of the shop. They came from nowhere. It was extraordinary. And that was my film, and I made it, and those events happened. And again, I got quite a bit of success out of that, because that little piece of film It got me another job, would you believe? It was a very, very nice, idyllic piece of filming.
No ducklings were harmed in the making of this episode of Sound and Director's Vision. Graham Harper, Sound and Director's Vision. And despite what Elton John may or may not say, if he ever sees the film, we will be back again with another volume in the very near future. Here's Elton John, and here, Graham, is...
Your Song.
It's a little bit funny, this feeling inside. I'm not one of those who can easily hide. I don't have much money, but boy, if I did, I'd buy a big house where we both could live. If I was a sculptor, but then again, no. Or a man who makes potions in a traveling show. I know it's not much, but it's the best I can do. My gift is my song, and this one's for you. And you can tell everybody this is your song. It may be quite simple, but now that it's done, I hope you don't mind, I hope you don't mind that I put down in words how wonderful life is while you're in the world. Top the moss. Well, a few of the verses, well, they've got me quite cross. But the sun's been quite kind while I wrote this song. It's for people like you that keep it turned on. So excuse me for getting, but these things I do, you see, I've forgotten if they're green or they're blue. Anyway, the thing is, what I really mean, yours are the sweetest eyes I've ever seen. You can tell everybody this is the song. It may be quite simple, but now that it's done, I hope you don't mind, I hope you don't mind that I put down in the words how wonderful life is while you're in. I hope you don't mind, I hope you don't mind that I put down in the words how wonderful life is while you're in the world.